and make this land a better land, and the world in which we live, and help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. And I know we can make it,
I know that we can,
I know darn well we can work it out.
Oh yes we can, I know we can, yes we can, and why can't we if we wanna, yes we can.
I know we can make it work,
I know that we can,
I know we can make it if we try.
Oh yes we can, I know we can, yes we can, great gosh almighty, yes we can, I know we can.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
It's time to pack your trunk and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being
held. Makes you such a threat.
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Uchasha, akang tu uchasha. Owe to na kecha ma khake le akang ompi. O ahu topa na khupahu yu khabi. Taka uskanskan a ompi ke le na iuha. Ma khake le akang tchanka taka un echa ke gena ke he on. O na ha ohoki chi la mani pikte. Ma khake le ohoki la mi moshi ke la. He on heche. Le on yu ita.
Tatangi mai eraro eave kama
kya ta.
Aloha kākou, e koma mai. Heartfelt greetings and welcome. I shake your hand with good feelings in my heart, and the whole world is a beautiful day. It's good for all of us to be here and to let the people hear your voice respectfully and to celebrate life together. This is First Voices Radio, coming to you this week from the illegally occupied Hawaiian Kingdom, known to most as the 50th state, Hawaii. I'm Ann Kalakili, sitting in this week for your host, Teokasin Ghost Horse. And on his behalf, mahalo nui for your generosity, as always, and for being here. Because without you, this show cannot go on. This is all Native hosted, all Native produced First Voices Radio, now in its 32nd year of broadcasting. Our First Voices Radio producer is the mighty Liz Hill. I want to welcome the more than 110 community, public, and commercial radio stations that carry First Voices Radio. And thank all of you who monitor this program online and around our mother, the Earth. Now, as Teokasin would say, let's count coup. This week, for the entire hour, we are discussing the terrifying uptick in syphilis infections and congenital syphilis cases in Indian country. This is a problem throughout the U.S., and it is hitting Indian country the hardest. Just to give you some background, national syphilis rates rose to a 70-year high between 2018 and 2022. The 2022 stats are the most recent CDC numbers. And we're in the midst of a penicillin shortage, which is the go-to drug for treating syphilis, except in cases of people who are allergic to penicillin. The rate of infection in 2022 was already 10 times higher than the decade before. In cases in newborn babies was up 183%. Congenital syphilis can mean death or severe health consequences for babies born to mothers who are oftentimes asymptomatic and because they lack prenatal care, unaware that they're infected. Coming up, a conversation with Amanda Singer, the executive director of the Navajo Breastfeeding Coalition, Dina Dula Collective. But first, let's have a listen to a song by Navajo singer-songwriter Sharon Birch. It's called Little One from her album Yazzie Girl.
What shall I sing for you? Little baby, time to put you in your crib.
Amanda Singer, aloha and welcome to First Voices Radio.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
There have been some stories in the media recently, and it's really alarming. Everybody at First Voices Radio is really grateful that you could join us today and talk about this incredibly difficult thing to talk about. And I'm not even sure why it's so difficult to talk about, Amanda. Help us understand the dramatic surge of syphilis in Indian country.
It could be a number of things. With my group, we are the Navajo Breastfeeding Coalition, and we have, I believe in 2020, we expanded our doula collective to a direct support program. And I think one of the things, like the feedback that we've been receiving from the community, and then just having general conversations, like when we're tabling or having our regular like lactation support circles and whatnot, a lot of the feedback that we've been getting is the lack of trust that our community has about going to the hospital. I think one of the things is just maybe they had maybe one bad situation that arised from like maybe one provider or maybe a nurse, and they particularly don't feel safe. You know, they end up not like they hold off on their prenatal appointments. And I know a lot of this discussion here is about the congenital syphilis rates.
Right. Yeah. No, a lot. That's a big part of the story that's unfolding. But talk a little bit about the state of women's health and maternal health specifically in Navajo Nation.
It's a maternal health desert, essentially. And I know that when me and my team members, you know, once we get referrals to do home visits, whether it's for a doula referral or a postpartum referral or a lactation support referral, we'll make our way out to their home. And even doing that, we're like traveling at times, like maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours away just to get to these homes. And sometimes it's like just for a quick check-in in the event that, let's say it's between appointments, there's very few of us. There's probably about, I would say, five or six that are practicing on the Navajo Nation. For those who are not familiar with the size of the Navajo Nation, you're looking at about approximately 24 to 25,000 square miles, which is essentially the same size as the state of West Virginia. Because there's only a few of us, sometimes we have to say, you know, no, you know, we can't take up certain referrals in certain parts of the Navajo Nation. There's the other thing too that we're running into is like more people are hearing more about home birth. It's really disheartening with that too, especially on the Arizona side of the Navajo Nation. We really don't have access to like home birth midwives.
And, oh, I see. Right.
Yeah. So a lot but of
help, first of all, before you go any further, help people understand the difference between a doula and a midwife.
A midwife is essentially the medical support person. They take care, they're responsible for all the medical needs of the patient. And for a doula, we're non-medical support and our birth support providers. And I know that some people have approached me from different parts of the Navajo Nation asking if I could be the one to catch their baby, you know, and the one being there conducting like home births and stuff. And I have to make that distinction and let them know that I'm not a midwife and I'm a doula. I'm there for like emotional, spiritual support, and also their advocate and physical support. But as far as the midwife goes, the midwife is trained to do more of the medical provisions. And then in the event that the patient needs to be transferred, the midwife would be the one to make that call. One of the things that we've been doing up here is just doing a lot of education around that.
A few months back, there was some reporting about not just the national syphilis issue, where rates are just skyrocketing, but the shortage of penicillin. That's typically the medicine that's applied unless the person has an allergy. So when you're encountering this, or when a midwife is encountering a woman who is infected, can you give her a shot, or do they have to go take that 2-hour drive into town to the hospital? What do they have to do to get treated?
The home birth midwives that I've worked with in the past, normally they do, they take them on a little, you know, early on in their prenatal period. They make sure, you know, that they have really good health throughout their pregnancy in order for them to birth at home. if they start seeing some concern regarding the prenatal individual or the pregnant individual's health, they start to become a candidate for a hospital transfer. And I know with the home birth midwives, they essentially work with certain labs, and they, you know, capture the labs. And I'm pretty sure, like with I know CNMs, and I think in New Mexico they're working on allowing the licensed midwives to have the power to prescribe, or they can refer them to get like a syphilis shot or a penicillin shot.
Let's circle back to the congenital syphilis issue. Why is that so much higher in Indian country? You're saying that's because they're not getting in there for prenatal care? Is that basically it? Or are there more natives that are getting infected? Like, what's the...
It's a number of things. Like, what I'm seeing as a community member, one thing I would like to bring out is that there are individuals in their community who are specifically say that they're, I guess you can say, quote unquote, straight or CIS. And then what happens is, like, especially with some of the males in our community, they may end up like having affairs with other men, but nobody really knows until it comes up in their partners. Like maybe the partner may start showing symptoms, or the partner may get pregnant and may not realize they were infected by syphilis. And I think a lot of people are aware of that, is that fact that there's like a lot of unprotected sex happening. Again, circling back around to some of our pregnant relatives, you know, they don't, there's been a number that I've been aware of to where they know that they're pregnant, but they really don't go to their prenatal appointments. And then they normally show up at the hospital until they're like in active labor.
Oh,
and
wow.
Usually by that time, it's a little too late. And so that's why we're trying to figure out how we can make it, you know, home births a little bit more accessible, because individuals may, or you know, the community may have a little bit more trust with like these home birth midwives, which can essentially be certified nurse midwives, licensed midwives, or certified professional midwives.
What's kind of the age range of is it women of all ages, or is it mostly younger women? What's the age demographic?
Young to possibly maybe into their, all the way up into their 30s, probably teen to their 30s.
Well, is syphilis just something a person just can have and not know for a long time? Is that what's going on? They're just not aware that they have it.
Maybe they're not, you know, maybe they're asymptomatic and they don't realize it. Mm-hmm. Or maybe there's certain things that are happening with their body and they're really not aware or sure of it. That second stage of syphilis, I believe you can develop a rash. And sometimes, you know, they may feel like it's probably because of an allergy they may have. I guess you can say maybe they're in denial. Maybe they just think, you know, maybe they think they're okay when in fact they really don't know, or they really don't want to go into the hospital. Because if they go into the hospital or they get tested by an organization that may do free STD, STI testing, it's going to make them face reality. Plus, we have a high substance use rate as well.
Are they running the risk of possibly losing their child?
Yes.
To CPS?
Yeah, they have a risk of losing the child, and also the child has a risk of neurological problems.
Well, let's talk about that. So what happens when a woman who has this infection gives birth? What happens to the baby? What's the danger here?
Well, the baby is going to be sick, or it could be a stillbirth. Again, I think, you know, there's different ways they screen for different, whether it's viral or bacterial infections. But I know that it's just an ugly, ugly disease. And I think there's just not, there's a lot of, like, back here on Navajo, when you talk about it openly, a lot of people don't want to hear about it. When it comes to talking about STDs and STIs and how it can impact an unborn child. You know, that's the one thing that really, it's really disheartening to see that, like, some of the, I mean, I've seen like the Navajo Health Education Program, and then also like the and they have a whole HIV prevention program. And then there's even some grassroots organizations that have these tests on hand, and they continue, you know, they offer these free tests. But a lot of the times you see a lot of the community members just kind of walking by and avoiding it.
Is that a cultural block? I mean, I don't know if I would call that a cultural block or just political, or what is the hesitation to reach out for help?
I think a lot of it, like, part of it is stubbornness, but then also, again, there's that whole issue of not trusting the hospital for a lot, you know, for different various reasons. And I also think that there's a teaching in our Navajo way where we talk about thinking of all the good things and, you know, having a positive outcome from thinking positively. And I think that's why a lot of people think, okay, well, if I start looking at that, then I might end up having that. You know, if I start reading information about STIs or STDs, you know, maybe that's, or they're going to think that they're kind of, I guess you can say, jinxing themselves per se, like quote unquote jinxing themselves and their health. But that's one thing. Like I've even shared information on my social media platforms, and a lot of the times, like some of my regular posts, like I try to post a lot of humorous posts, I get a huge response. And then, like, for me, like, when I post pictures of myself on my personal page, and then also pictures of my team on our coalition Facebook page, there's a lot of feedback happening, a lot of interaction. But when I post specific information about the situation around syphilis, and then the increased rates, and then also the scary rise of congenital syphilis cases, and then even sharing information about maternal mortality in indigenous communities, and also the drastic increase in infant mortality in indigenous communities. So, you know, when I post specifics like that, know that I really don't have any interest. Like everybody just decides to go quiet. And I think that's the problem, is that nobody's talking about it. Nobody's openly talking about it. A lot of people really just want to ignore it because it's bad. But then when I do post stuff like that, especially around infant mortality, a lot of these people too are individuals who are like really vouch about being pro-life. But when people start saying pro-life, they have to realize it means a lot more than what they think. They just think Roe versus Wade. But I think if you're going to be pro-life, you have to also be out there advocating in every aspect of the unborn's future. Try to do your best to protect their life, that they have a healthy outcome when they're born, as opposed to having something that could either debilitate them for the rest of their life or literally kill them.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. Let me ask you this. In terms of Indian Health Services, or how are they able to interact with women who are not seeking prenatal care early on?
Right now, I know I've seen different various campaigns from Indian Health Service. Like they do try to do their best at tabling in the community and sharing information about trying to increase their or spread the awareness of the importance of receiving prenatal care. And I've seen different campaigns go out there, because I know this is something that's been consistent, though, like even before the whole situation around congenital syphilis, there's like years that were where I've been hearing about women not going in to get their prenatal care until like the very last minute, like when they're laboring is when they'll finally make their way to the hospital. But I've seen different campaigns, and then also I've seen other organizations that work within perinatal health, maternal health, infant health, what have you, that have been doing their own campaigns and really trying to emphasize why it's important to get prenatal care.
Have you yourself in your work encountered a birth taking place with an infected mother?
No. Not myself, or not any of our doulas. The only group that I think that would come close to that would be the UNM Birth Companion Program. The reason why I'm saying that is because usually within our team, We normally take on prenatals pretty early on, like maybe at the end of the first trimester to the second or early second trimester. And we just make sure that they are receiving prenatal care, whether it's by, you know, a birth center, a home birth midwife, or the hospital. And so that there, and then we also make sure that, you know, we're that person in the back saying, just make sure, you know, this is important. We're educating them on why it's important and why they need to get their labs done and everything. So we're like, they hear it from their provider, whether it's a midwife, home birth midwife, or maybe even an obstetrician. They're hearing it from them, but then also when they see us, they're hearing it again from us.
That's a really great program that you have going then. So you, it's important, I think, for people to look into what it is you offer through the collective for pregnant women.
The reason why I mentioned the UNM Birth Companion Program is usually any of their patients who may request a doula at their birth, they can get a doula and or a birth companion there, like within about a few hours after the request has been made, and then they help them through the birth. And I think from that, you know, I think that program may have more of a general sense of what that looks like. Because for us, normally, even with any late referrals, and sometimes like if my schedule is open to it, like the late referrals, I'll get them like maybe between 36 weeks gestation. And I'll start asking them questions. And then normally I end up showing up with them like maybe for one or two prenatal appointments in their third trimester. So even at that, you know, we are aware of, by that time we have a general awareness of how their health is doing. And are aware of like the type of tests that they have, you know, gotten done. And so by the time the birth outcome, you know, happens, we are aware that they have been, you know, went through the STD, STI screening. And if they did have one, they were treated for it. And so by the time the birth happens, you know, the baby usually comes out without an STD or STI.
Let's take a short break here and let Sharon Birch bless us with another one of her gorgeous songs. This one is called Grandmother's Ways from her album, Touch the Sweet Earth.
It's hard to go, didn't ya?
Welcome back to First Voices Radio and my conversation with Amanda Singer from the Navajo Breastfeeding Coalition, Dinah Dula Collective. I mean, the first thing I thought when I heard about this was this is like a totally preventable disease.
Exactly. It is 100% preventable. And there's just so many things out there that like contributing factors, I guess you can say, to this whole issue. And then just people like I was saying, it's just so, what I'm seeing is just a lot of ignorance. People don't want to hear about STDs or STIs for whatever reason. But then again, you know, it's real. It's out there. It's essentially killing our babies. And when you look at the infant mortality rates, especially among AIAN communities, you'll see that there's even a drastic increase in that just more recently. That's just the scary thing for me too. And it's like trying to figure out what's going on. And I think a lot of the tribal and federal state governments, and then also nonprofit organizations, grassroots organizations who are already involved in this work, I think we just need to put our heads together and figure out what we need to do.
Also, I think that there's the ignorance factor and the fear factor, but there's also the communication factor. I know Native women love their babies just like non-Native women. So it isn't that. It's something else. And these things have to be solved because this is an unacceptable, preventable crisis. And I know that it's not just happening to Natives, but it's hitting Natives the hardest.
Yeah, just like everything else, you know.
Yeah.
Even during COVID, it was mainly Natives that were getting hit particularly hard by that.
I feel like anybody of internet age is inundated with stuff that makes them more vulnerable to sexual anything.
Mm-hmm.
Are you seeing that too? Or am I just, that's my imagination?
I'm seeing that too. I mean, I'm seeing that here. But I think it's like what they see on social media, on TV. Yeah, I'm seeing that here too. And it's kind of like, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because like, think, you know, talking as a Native person, specifically Diné, I know that I was brought up on some really harsh teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe there's like a cultural difference there, because what I mean, not cultural, but difference, but I think there's the language barrier, I think, has a lot to do with it too, because I know a lot of the teachings I was raised in, I heard and learned it with our Navajo language. It was always Navajo with my family, where when they would lecture us, it was always entirely in Navajo. And so, like, when you try to translate as much as you possibly can in English, you really miss the main core points of the translation in Navajo.
Mm.
And then, like, I think that, you know, a lot of people are really stern, like the older generation, and a lot of people think that they're mean. But I think that's how they come across, because our languages, I think, we're just straight to the point, like hit the nail on the head, no matter how harsh it may come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the younger generation, I think, is missing that factor, especially the ones that don't know their language.
What are the three most important things that you want people to know about this dramatic rise in syphilis?
Well, one, to use protection, because this is completely preventable. I don't even know of any healthcare, you know, systems that don't give free condoms. You have condoms to at least decrease your risk of getting or transferring STD or STI to someone. And then two, there needs to be more of a campaign. The tribal health programs, hospitals, and then also community orgs like the Navajo Breastfeeding Coalition, we really need to work together. And I think we have to really partner together to help spread the awareness about it and talk more openly about it, instead of, you know, just tiptoeing around and not really speaking openly about it, because it's affecting our babies. It's affecting our future generation. And I think that should be enough to move forward with, you know, as a community, as, you know, in partnership collectively. That, I guess, for this, it's like a call to Indian Health Service, our tribal health programs, 638 tribal hospitals, and then any community orgs or grassroots organizations who are working around, you know, perinatal, maternal, or infant health, and or infant health. You know, we really need to come together as a team, unite, and then also, you know, to spread awareness and be all on the same page as we help each other. And then number three, the maternal health deserts. We need to also create other safe options for Indigenous communities. I mean, there's a lot of negative, I guess, rhetoric out there about home births, and a lot of people think they're unsafe. But as long as there's a midwife there and she's there making sure that her patient's health is good all the way through the pregnancy to have a home birth, and then also making sure that there's a way, if in the event that there needs to be a transfer, that there's a healthcare system close enough to make that transfer. I think Indigenous communities also just need that choice, not just having to focus on the hospital, but they can, like, maybe they can have birth centers or maternal or perinatal health hubs out there in the most rural parts of the Navajo Nation, where that health hub could actually have, whether it's certified nurse midwives or licensed midwives or a certified professional midwives, and even having like birth support workers, you know, like doulas working in that health hub and being able to go out and do home visits to the community. And then taking all of their testing kits and stuff like that with them, just so that they can keep up on that. Because right now it's really sad that we still have community members that have to travel like maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, maybe even 3 hours away to just make a regular hospital appointment. And sometimes they have a local hospital in their community, but they prefer to get treatment in a different hospital. I mean, I know Fort Defiance or Teta Medical Center, a lot of their patients are not just generally within the community. I mean, I know of people who travel all the way from, let's say, Greasewood, Arizona, or Delcon, just to receive their patient, you know, their patient care here. And those communities are like an hour to an hour and a half away from here. If there was like maternal health or perinatal health hubs that gives people an option to be able to receive like their care, and then if there is something that's a little bit more urgent or more serious, then these individuals would catch it, meaning the midwives that work there, or maybe they'll have like perinatal home visitors. I think they may be able to catch certain things out there before it runs its course, meaning like viral infections, bacterial infections, or maybe even like domestic violence situations. You know, they'll be able to catch it and be able to help that family or their patient to acquire care. And I think that's the one thing that I'm seeing with the Indian Health Services and then the tribal hospitals out here, is that they do have like public health nurses and then nurses within, you know, their community health program that go out to a certain range. You know, they're able to do home visits, but they only can go so far and they can't go out, you know, further. Maybe creating little hubs like that would actually help and decrease a lot of, not just the syphilis rate, but let's say HIV rates and any STD or STIs out there, but also increase our community members, our pregnant relatives, increase their access to prenatal exams, increase their access to postpartum exams. And I think that's one thing, that the key thing that's missing is meeting the community at where they're at. I know like a few years ago, within the pandemic, we did help support some of our clients within the home birth. But when I seen that home birth midwifery team, what they were doing was that they were leaving their office or their birth center and then traveling out to this person's home. And they would do their entire prenatal exam within their patient's home. And then like they alternated the in-person and also the virtual visit. So even during the virtual visit, what they did was they incorporated the family, the dad, the partner, to be there. And they taught their the partner or the main support person there at home how to do like blood pressure checks. They taught them how to properly take a weight, their prenatal weight. And then they also taught them how to do their, you know, their little urine test. So when that happened, you know, I was seeing a lot of inclusion of the partner, but also they were able to do like some of their labs there. And then, you know, they do what they need to make sure that it was safe and still good when they transported it back to the different labs that they were working with.
So it's really about empowering them where they are.
Yes, I think that is what one of the main missing keys are within each Indigenous community or Native community within the USA, you know, within our country. And I think that's the key factor of it, because what I've seen with the home birth midwives that I worked with, they go out to meet their patients. They go to their home. They get to know the family. They gain the family's trust. And then, you know, I've seen a lot of really good interaction. And then I've also seen where they had no other choice, like at the end stage of pregnancy, if they have concerns of their patient's health, I've seen them transfer them to the local hospital just so that they can get the upper tier of care. That's how careful they are. And I really appreciate the home birth midwives, which again, there's like three different ones. There's a certified nurse midwife, there's licensed midwives, and certified professional midwives. And how I've seen them work is really beautiful, but I just really wish that every community, Indigenous community, had access like that, because I really believe that what I've seen, particularly during the pandemic, I think it really helped a lot of families and also helped our Navajo relatives who were able to receive that type of care.
Well, I have two questions, or two and a half questions. The half question is, where is here? When you say here, where are you?
I'm actually talking to you from Fort Defiance, Arizona. And the Navajo Breastfeeding Coalition, we do our best to cover the entirety of the Navajo Nation. Just like I said, there's only, I think, maybe five or six of us back here. And we also have a few direct support providers, like in the Phoenix area, and also Albuquerque.
And when you referenced the pandemic just now, just if you can briefly explain how that success with what the Navajo Nation was able to do during the pandemic, how that can influence creating a successful outcome here with regard to congenital syphilis.
I think it's just, again, back to what you had mentioned earlier, just empowering the community. And also, like, even with, I don't want to talk like negatively about the hospital, because they are there for a reason, and there's like several good providers that I've come across in different Indian Health Service hospitals and tribal hospitals. But I also believe that a lot of our community members are still dealing and healing from historical trauma. So when they go into the hospital, a lot of them don't know how to, or they don't want to, or maybe they really don't know how to advocate for themselves. And I think that's one thing too, is just creating the partnerships that we had, like during the pandemic, to make sure and ensure that some of these families who were afraid to go to the hospital because of COVID, we were able to provide, like, help with referrals and resources to these midwives who actually came out and helped with births. You know, we were able to help uplift their group because of what we were seeing. I think if that could be incorporated in different, you know, Indigenous communities, and then also the healthcare systems actually recognizing that home birth can be safe, and that people who, like the home birth midwives that do help it, you know, they're a tool that they should be using. There's still a lot of taboo around home births, and people forget that our ancestors were doing that. You know, they had their own Indigenous midwife, and then they also had their herbs and their medicines. And that's why we're still here. And it kind of, I guess to me, I'm just like, when people say, I don't think it's safe, you know, and I've had to come in with families where previous clients were telling me, so-and-so, my family feel that home birth is unsafe. And then they would ask me to come in and talk with the families sometimes, and I would explain to them the process and stuff like that, and what I've experienced with home birth midwifery teens. And I think just the one thing that gives them a peace of mind is I also let them know that they're not stubborn. You know, if they see a need for your relative to be transferred for a higher tier or higher level care, then they'll make sure that this person, your relative, is transferred. They're not going to chance it with the home birth.
I'm thinking two things from what you're saying. Since time immemorial, women have given birth at home. So it's like talking about a tradition versus an industry in terms of how people think.
Yeah. And I really wish that the industry would listen to, you know, our history. And I think if they would recognize that we do know what we're doing and what we do, and that our priority is that our community is safe.
Well, the other thing that I thought of when you were talking is the Navajo Nation is its own nation. I mean, it's not the American culture. They're foreign. The American system or way of dealing with pregnant Native women it's somewhat foreign, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like it's still kind of foreign to people there.
Yeah. Yes. From what, because I think the other downside too that I see with our tribal hospitals and Indian Health Service is that there's such a high turnover rate, and then some providers are only here for a short time and then they move on. And I think that's like one of the things that for my own family, you know, sometimes like with their primary care provider, I've also known like them having to change them out consistently because their former primary care provider may have been there for like anywhere from 6 months to a year, and then they move and then they have to get used to another primary care provider. And sometimes I think the community just gets tired of that. Because even though they have to change primary care providers, that also means that they have to go through a whole round and battery of testing again, which they may have just done a few months back with their previous PCP. Or I hear a lot of talk about that in the community and even in my family. You know, they're always saying like, ah, my PCP left and now I'm assigned to another one. And then it's like they have to start a whole new relationship with this primary care provider. That in itself, it's not something that just happens on Navajo, but it more than likely is happening in other Indigenous communities. You build trust with one and then that person leaves, and then you have to work on building trust again.
The system is not Native friendly is what I hear you saying.
No, it's not Native friendly. I'm glad that more recently too, like our local hospital here at Teotihuacan Medical Center, and then I think it was Northern Navajo Medical Center, and then Gallup Indian Medical Center, they've been more open about hearing more Navajo cultural teachings around birth. And the interesting thing about Teotihuacan Medical Center, when I met with them a few months back, they were beginning to think like, how can we incorporate all those practices into our L&D, our labor and delivery floor? And I'm glad that, you know, they're beginning to think about that, but they haven't reached out back to me to let me know if they're actually incorporating or working with Navajo practitioners that work within the hospital. But it would be interesting to find out if they are. They still honor, of course, they honor and respect traditional practices in general. When you're going to do something like bring in a medicine person onto, you know, to do a prayer on a patient. But it would be nice to know like what other things they're incorporating within, you know, birth and pregnancy and postpartum.
Well, Amanda, where can people find information about what you do? And also, where can they find out more about how to help solve this problem?
Well, we do have a Facebook page. It's called, you can find it under Navajo Breastfeeding Coalition. And then also you can email me at DineNationBreastfeeding@gmail.com. And for any information, like for anybody who wants to maybe donate to our cause, but all of our donations we use back into our coalition to do our community work and also to... just to help our prenatal, you know, birthing, postpartum relatives. And then we also help around lactation support. And we are beginning to venture into like some policy work. So there's a lot of things that we are involved in. And all of our money does go into helping support the different projects that we're involved in.
Really, it's great work that you folks are doing. And one last question, would you encourage people to contact their own tribal health services just to get more information so that they're informed on this issue?
Yes, for the Navajo Nation, you can look at any Navajo area Indian health services. You can Google Indian Health Service and then you'll find like the contact information all in there. And then as well as Teoto Medical Center, they have their own website too, if you want to know more information. And then I believe you can even like, I know the Navajo Nation, we have our own Department of Health, which is the Navajo Department of Health. I believe that you can even reach out to them to access more information, or you can just reach out to me and then I can connect you with whoever you want, whoever you need to be connected with.
Well, thank you so much for coming on First Voices Radio and helping us understand this really complicated but solvable crisis. And I hope we have you on the show again not too long from now to update us on the success of all the changes that are going to be taking place, hopefully.
Yeah, and just thank you, Ikihat and Tago, just basically meaning a huge thank you for inviting me to be here. You know, it was a good discussion.
Once again, mahalo nui loa for sharing this sacred time with me. We close now with The Peacemaker is Born from the late Joanne Shenandoah's epic 2000 album, Peacemaker's Journey, which is about Skana Lahawe, the great peacemaker, who introduced the great law of peace to the Haudenosaunee people, which according to oral tradition appeared as early as AD 1142. The Haudenosaunee, among millions of native peoples residing in all regions of the North American continent, pre-European invasion and colonization, were the first to create a sophisticated, modern form of governing. Political power was held in balance by an elaborate system of checks and a view of individual freedom. And this was hundreds of years before the U.S. and the United Nations came into existence. Pray for peace. Demand peace. Don't settle for anything less than peace. Ahui ho, malama pono. Until next time, be righteous.
Skana Lahawe, gonto, luna glad. O whiskla, negane yota. Wait on your door. Go away, ya ho wa te we ingwe huwe. Ladano said. Gonna the highway, going to learn a glass, a whisklaw. Negana yoda, wait on your door. Go. Negana yoda, wait on your door. Go away, no says ooh,
you are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and the McMiniman's Crystal Ballroom, presenting Reckless Kelly, The Last Frontier Tour, with guests Tyler and the Train Robbers on Friday, June 13th. Tickets and info for this all-ages show